everybody. Welcome. It's time to listen to It's All About Food, and I'm Karen Hartglass. And who are you? I don't know, because you haven't been sending me messages at info@realmeals.org, and I want to hear from you. So whether you have questions or not, just if you're listening, let me know you're out there. I want to say hi, okay? Now, it's hot here in New York City, and we're dealing. I'm not someone who likes air conditioning very much, so I'm trying to work that out, staying cool, calm, collected. But I want to, just for a moment, I do this from time to time, I just want to mention three quick things that I'm thankful for. You know, whenever you're feeling not quite your best, or even if you are feeling pretty good, it's always good to think about things you're grateful for. So maybe for a minute you can think about three things, just three things. What are you grateful for? Right now, I'm grateful for Go Organic NYC, and this is not a promo or anything plugging this organization, even though I am plugging them. I'm not getting anything for it. It's a wonderful local organization that delivers produce, and I just got a stunning delivery of collards and kale and celery, all these great materials. I call them juicing materials because I make my juice for the week, green juice, so I have a glass of green juice, at least 12 ounces every day. And what I do is I make it once, put everything in glass jars, and then freeze them. So every day I have one little gift in the freezer that I take out and let defrost and have a juice to drink. And it works out really great, and I'm grateful for that, these wonderful foods that arrive at my door. The other thing I'm grateful for are beans, and I can't say enough about beans. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about them later, but I just had a big bowl of them, and I was hungry, and now I'm stuffed. And they're just a great food. You can do so many different things with them. They're really healthy. They help you maintain your weight, and they clean out your intestines, and that's the last thing that I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for being regular. Bowel movements. I've been hearing a lot about people being constipated, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that if we have a moment. But it's nice to keep moving, get the food in, let it go in, the body takes what it needs, and then moves the rest out. And then when something's stuck, when it's not flowing, everything stops and you feel really uncomfortable. Think about beans. They can really help keep things moving. All right, that's my message for today. That's the three things that I'm grateful for. And now I want to bring on a wonderful guest. He's been on the program before, Jane Boris. And he's been exploring and teaching a variety of meditation practices since 1970. And we're going to hear quite a bit about that and his practice and what he calls effortless mind meditation. Jane, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hey, thank you so much, Karen. Great to be back.
Yeah, well, you had a free one-hour webinar last week, and I've been telling my listeners about it, and I was listening, and I enjoyed it very much. And I understand that it's available on replay right now.
Yes. So probably the best way to find it is to just go to my website, effortlessmindmeditation.com. So it's effortlessmindmeditation.com. You go to the classes page, which is, you know, the first page. And in the right-hand corner there, you'll see our free webinar, Yes, I Want to See It button. And if you click that, it'll get you to that webinar. And on the webinar, basically what I do is it's entitled Secrets of Effortless Mind Meditation, something about getting rid of anxiety and experiencing deep peace and relaxation. In the webinar, what I do is I talk about three really essential secrets to successful meditation. And these secrets really apply to any form of meditation. And then I actually teach a very easy, quick form of meditation that just puts you into a deep state in just a few minutes. And then I also, kind of as a bonus, we talk quite a bit about the latest exciting research on meditation. So those are the highlights of the free webinar.
I found that really fascinating, especially the research. I've been reading quite a bit on meditation in mainstream papers. The New York Times and New Yorker regularly have articles talking about how so many high-powered executives today, CEOs, people in very stressful situations, are now turning to meditation, and businesses include meditation practices for their employees. And this is a really good thing. Now, I'm really into health and nutrition, and one thing that I frequently tell to people in my private coaching practice and also people who listen to this program is, if we're full of stress and anxiety, we're eating, it's a disaster. Mm. We're not going to get the nutrition we need. There's going to be all kinds of chemicals swimming around that are going to not do what we need. And even though you may be eating as healthfully as possible, if you're full of stress and anxiety, you're going to have issues, healthful issues. And that's why I think meditation is even more important than good nutrition. And for somebody who's so passionate about food to say that, I realize how powerful it is.
Yes. Well, that is wonderful for you to say that. I also feel, you know, nutrition's really important. In fact, I was going to ask you something about juicing, but I'll hold off on that question and just address what you just are bringing up here. And, you know, it's absolutely true. I mean, they've done a lot of studies and found people don't perform well at work. They, you know, that you can't enjoy your life. You don't perform as well at school if you're anxious or depressed, you know. So it's no surprise that your, you know, your body isn't also going to digest your food properly if you're flooded with the chemistry of anxiety or stress. And so just like our body has, you know, there's a biochemistry that is correlated with anxiety, with depression, with anger. There's also a whole biochemistry that's associated with that meditative state. And even beyond that, you can start to cultivate a biochemistry of bliss, where you just feel the sense of well-being, of wholeness, of peace, at ease, and also your, you know, there's a lot of kind of creative juices flowing in that state. And that has its own biochemistry too. And that's going to be, you know, much more beneficial to be digesting all that healthy food that you're recommending if you're in that state.
You know, I want to say better living with biochemistry, or better living through through chemistry, like DuPont used to say as their slogan decades ago, brings a whole right. new meaning, and the real meaning, I think, of better living with chemistry, and that's our own healthy biochemistry from good thoughts. I wanted to say I went through advanced ovarian cancer and in 2006, and doctors and medical professionals and all kinds of, and my insurance companies, they all made mistakes. I always had to be on guard, and it was a very scary time. And I discovered it was miraculous, but when I started regular meditation, my fear went away. It was so powerful and so empowering, and that's one of the reasons why I really believe in it. But we can really craft our thoughts and our feelings and make them truly our own with meditation.
Well, you know, what you're talking about here reminds me of one of the studies that I discuss in the webinar, where they actually found that stress creates a chemistry in the system that shortens the telomeres. And telomeres are these sort of caps. They're sort of like end caps on the chromosomes and or on the DNA, I think it is. And I'm not a scientist. I'm reading this research, and on the webinar I report it more, you know, exactly as it's stated in the study. But here I'm just off the top of my head saying that these telomeres shorten, When the telomeres get to a certain shortness, there, you know, when they've been degraded to a certain point, then the cells can no longer reproduce and they die. And so what happens during meditation, so stress actually shortens the telomeres. It's actually weakening the cell and shortening the lifespan of our cells. And whereas during meditation, they've found that there's a production of an enzyme called telomerase. And telomerase actually helps to rebuild the telomeres, and so they actually grow longer, which strengthens the cells and makes them more vital so they can divide and reproduce and live longer. And so this is amazing implications that suggest that meditation is going to increase longevity as well as vitality and health. So anyway, that's just a little quick preview of some of the research I talk about on that in the webinar.
Yeah, I was very excited when I heard that. You know, but we're talking on and on here about meditation, and let's get to the basics for a moment, because many people talk about meditation. There are many things that go by the name of meditation. What do you mean by meditation?
That's a great question, and it's it's not a simple answer, but I'll try to, okay, just off the top of my head, what I would say is meditation is the process of going from the conscious thinking level, and that's where we're hanging out all day long. That's where we're experiencing thoughts, our conscious mind. And it's going from that level of awareness of thought to a subtler or quieter level of thought, to a quieter, more abstract level, and to a very faint impulse of a thought at the deepest level of the mind. And then even that dissolves, and you don't fall asleep at that point. You're still aware, but now there's no object of awareness. You're simply abiding in the state of pure awareness, just simple awareness itself. And so that is kind of the course of meditation, going from the conscious mind through these subtler layers of the mind to finally transcend the finest impulse of thought and just abide in pure awareness, which is your very core. That's what I call meditation.
Now, I'm telling people to meditate all the time, and I recommend things, and I get different kinds of reactions, and some people say, oh, no, I get even more anxious when I meditate. I'm too uptight, and I can't sit still. What do you do with
them?
These people?
Right. Okay. So, first off, I have to say, I think that it's really important to get good instruction in meditation. I tried to teach myself. I tried to learn just by reading some books. This was many, many years ago. And I found it really frustrating. And actually there's actually a lot of misunderstanding about meditation. And the reason that is because, sort of the end of meditation is mistaken for the means. And what I mean by that is the end of meditation is this silent state, this abiding in pure awareness where thoughts have subsided and you're just in this expansive pure awareness. So people tend to think, and many instructors of meditation tend to think, that the way then to meditate is to silence the mind. And so they endeavor to somehow still their thoughts, to try to control thoughts, which is really an impossibility. You can't control the mind. If you try to do that, you're going to be very frustrated. So the reason I call effortless mind meditation effortless mind is because it's recognizing that anytime you shift from the conscious thinking mind into another state of consciousness, be that sleep or dreaming or meditation, it has to be easy. It has to be effortless. I mean, just think about when you fall asleep. If you're trying to fall asleep, what happens? You stay awake. You toss and turn. You just want to stop trying. It has to happen naturally. And the same holds true of meditation, because if you're trying to meditate, even the slightest bit of trying, it keeps the mind on the surface. That activity of trying keeps you in the conscious waking state, in the ego mind. And it's only when you kind of effortlessly fall into meditation that you have a good deep meditation. And so, of course, the key is to learn that art of falling into meditation reliably every time you sit to meditate. And then you'll find that meditation's always effortless. It's always deep and you always get the benefits. And it's simple and easy to do. But it takes some instruction to do that. So that's the thing. That's the kind of key to meditation. In fact, that's the first secret that I talk about in the webinar.
So the trick is to learn the art of meditation. I guess it's like crawling and walking and then running one thing at a time.
Yes, ironically, it's almost the reverse of that. Right now we're running. We're always doing things. And so we want to slow down and do less and do less and less and less until we're finally just being and we're abiding in that core of our being. So it's just the reverse of that. But you got the right idea.
Now, there are so many benefits to meditation, and it's supposed to bring clarity and focus and make us more efficient and make our work somewhat easier, and yet people struggle because they are all busy and they don't know where in the day they can find time to sit and be still.
Right. That is one of the things that kind of catches people. And the thing about that is, first off, you have to realize your mind is the lens through which you experience life. And meditation has the effect, as you said, of really calming the mind, clearing out the clutter, allowing you to be fully present in your life and enjoy it so much more. So first off, there is a great value in that. I mean, that is something worth having. It's worth investing a few minutes of your day to start to experience that. So, and the other thing is, once you experience that, you have more. Oops, I apologize for the dogs in the background. I hope they're not too loud.
They have something to say.
And once you have that, because you are fully present, you can be much more efficient in whatever you do. And also you're using more of the mind so you can be more creative. In fact, some more of the research that I talk about on the webinar is meditation has been shown to actually increase intelligence and creativity as well as improve memory. And so, I mean, you can just be more productive if you are using more of, you know, what you have. So really it's a good investment. I mean, probably a lot of your listeners have heard that story that, Gandhi was talking to some of his supporters and he said, and they were looking at his schedule and he said, well, I have to meditate at least an hour a day. And they said, oh, Gandhi, you know, you can't do that. You're too busy. You have too much to do. And he said, oh, well, in that case, I better meditate 2 hours a day.
I love that story. I really love it. You know,
We can take a lesson from that, you know.
Absolutely. You mentioned improved memory. So as I'm getting older and my friends and family members are getting older, some people are being plagued with memory loss and dementia and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Meditation can help brain health. Does it help with these diseases and ailments?
Well, okay, I'm sort of doing a spoiler here on my webinar, but yes, another one of the research studies, a couple of studies to this effect that have been very exciting. You know, as we grow older, they find that there's certain parts of our brain that are really critical to our rational thought and our attention. And those parts of the brain, as we grow older, tend to thin out. And actually, the actual mass of our brain gets less and the brain becomes lighter. And this is might concern you because we want our brain to stay healthy and vital and in as good a shape as ever. Well, what they found in these recent studies is that in longer-term meditators, those areas of the brain have actually not only been preserved, but they're thicker than the non-meditators, and so they're actually getting more brain matter. Their brain is actually becoming more as they age. And that's just really amazing. You know, that suggests that we don't have to experience
and
that decline.
Everybody should be doing this.
Yes. I mean, there's many good reasons to do meditation. And like you say, almost every week, more research comes out, showing the benefits of meditation. So it's getting to be a no-brainer, you know, that this is a good thing to do.
It's I'm trying to make a pun with no-brainer, but I'm not. I'm just going to skip over that.
I sort of hesitated to say that because it was kind of a pun, but whatever.
Okay. For people that aren't familiar with you and your work, I just want to say that you've taken many long retreats. You've lived in a cave at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas for months in silence, eating one meal a day.
True,
Why did you do this? Why is this necessary?
Well, you know, first off, it's not necessary. It is nice. I've been a very passionate, dedicated meditator since 1970, and I've explored, meditation and studied with various teachers all around the world. And for 4 years, I lived in India, and I taught at an ashram there. I taught meditation. Some of the listeners may know of Amichi. She's sometimes called the hugging saint. Anyway, I was the meditation teacher at her ashram for 4 years. And when she would leave the ashram and go on a world tour, I would head up to the Himalayas and I would find a cave and take a retreat. And I did this because, of course, on a retreat, it's just a chance to take a sort of a giant step in your progress. But what I recommend to people who maybe aren't as extreme as I am a weekend retreat from time to time, maybe a couple times a year, is just fabulous. It does help to kind of step back, get out of your normal routine, really dive deep into meditation, and you just get supercharged. So that's definitely of value. You don't have to do the silence. You certainly don't have to live in a cave. But by the way, I will say, if anybody's interested, in October, I'm taking people, a small group, to the Himalayas, and we're going to have a meditation retreat, up to the source of the Ganges, which is where I did my meditating up there. And we don't stay in caves. We stay in the best facilities available. And it's just a wonderful experience of kind of a cultural immersion. And, of course, you have the beauty of the Himalayas. So it's just fabulous. And, again, if people have an interest in that, they can look at my website, effortlessmindmeditation.com.
Now, you're a family man and you have children now.
That's true.
And how old are your children?
Well, they're not. Let's see, one is 35 and one is 27. And
okay, they're grown up.
They've actually both live in India. They came when those 4 years that I lived in India, the whole family lived there. And so that was a very formative experience for them. And now they're just very keen on their sort of spiritual growth. And they live in India, at least for now.
Wow. I just wondered, when they were really young, did you go through some sort of meditation techniques with them?
Well, yes, absolutely. They're both fabulous meditators.
Because I'm thinking that if it was part of our culture, it would be so much easier if we were just raised with meditation, just like breathing and eating and watching television. Meditation would just be one of those normal things, and it would be so easy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it should be taught in schools. I mean, in many cases, it actually is. There are schools that teach meditation, and it's becoming more a part of the culture than it was, say, just 20, 40 years ago. So we're getting there. We're slowly but surely getting there.
Great. So you said you had a question about green juice, and I thought now would be a good time for you to ask it.
Okay. So I juice every morning, and I love it, and it does feel very healthy. But the one thing I just don't like about it is all of the, you know, what the sort of refuse that comes, you know, the grindings that come from the juice. And of course, we've tried different things with those. We've composted, we've fed them to our dogs. I've even made soup out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you do with the leftovers after that juicing process?
Right. So I know many people think it's wasteful. And the first thing is, not everyone needs to juice. People can blend those foods and get the fiber, and then they would be eating it. And for many people, that's very good. But for people that want more energy or want or in a health crisis and really want to heal, or they just like it, there is this leftover fiber. And composting is a great thing if you can do it, because then it's really not wasted. The nutrients go back into the earth, and that's fine. I used to compost, but I live in an apartment in New York City, and it's just not designed for composting.
Right.
So unfortunately, right now, I just put it in the waste and wish it well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I've also found composting to be kind of difficult. We just have one of those barrels, and you have to add other stuff into it. And it's a bit of a, you know, an exercise, and we don't always have the time. So,
right.
You know,
now, sometimes it depends on what I'm making in my juice, because I typically use kale and collard, celery, and lemon. But if I'm heavier on the, celery and carrots, for example, I might juice them first and save that fiber and make vegetable broth with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't use the dark greens in vegetable broth, because that can get a little skunky.
Okay. Well, great. Is there much nutrition left over in that, you know, the fibers that are left?
You know, I'm going to say I don't know. There's certainly fiber. And it depends on how efficient your juicer is. I like to pass. Here's one thing that I do. Depending on the juicer that you have, some are better than others. I take that fiber and I run it through the juicer a bunch of times to squeeze out every possible juice that I can get from it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of wastes a little less.
But right. We've done that too.
Juicing is really a luxury. And I'm grateful to be able to juice. I really think it had a tremendous impact on my survival and my health, and I'm glad that we're able to do it.
Yeah, me too. I love it. And sometimes we do make shakes. You know, it just depends, but mostly we juice. Well, great. All right. Well, we're on the same page,
so
it sounds
just
like.
Before
well,
we
if
go,
I could just mention one last time, and the way to find that webinar, which is effortlessmindmeditation.com, and then go to the classes page and you'll see the button, and it is available until August 11th. So at least until then, you can click on that button and see the free webinar.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Jane, for joining me again on It's All About Food. And I hope we do meet up in New York like we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. I am going to connect with you next time I come to New York City. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, Karen.
You're welcome. Thank you. Take care.
All right. You too.
All right. That was Jane Boris, the author of Effortless Mind and the creator of Effortless Mind Meditation. And you can also go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a link to that one-hour webinar if you want to find it and listen to it. And you can, as he said, listen to it until August 11th. And I really recommend it. Just find the time. And then all of a sudden, you'll find you'll have more time for everything. Let's take a little break, shall we? And then we'll be back with Grace Kim, and we're going to be talking about urban rooftop farming.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, Part 2. Okay. Were you meditating during that little break? Why not? You know what I like to do sometimes? When you're standing in a line somewhere, and it's a really, really long, aggravating line, you have lots of things to do and lots of places to go, but the line's not moving, you're not moving, and whatever it is, you have to get it done, so you have to stay in that line. You've been there. I know, we've all been there. Well, that is a great moment for a standing meditation. And once you get into it, it really shifts your whole awareness, perception, and I promise you, you will be feeling fabulous because all of a sudden, you get into this calm. And what is a silent meditation? You just stand straight, good posture, do some low, deep breaths, smile to yourself, and just don't react to everything around you. All of a sudden, you've made a choice, and it's a positive choice for yourself, where you're not buying into all of the craziness. It's really powerful, and it can be a very wonderful, joyful thing. So I recommend that the next time you're standing in some ridiculous line. Okay, just remember, Karen told you, standing meditation. All right, that was a little tip. And now let's move on to the second guest today. We have Grace Kim, and she's the founding principal of Schemata Workshop and has been practicing architecture in Chicago and Seattle for more than 20 years. She's a consensus builder, helping her clients and project stakeholders envision how a completed project will be experienced. She's a compassionate listener, sensitive designer, paying attention to both the present and future needs of her clients. She's the author of The Survival Guide to Architectural Internship and Career Development, and in 2008 was a recipient of the National AIA Young Architect Award. She served for 4 years on the board of Co-Housing Association of the U.S., and we're going to be talking a little bit about co-housing and urban rooftop farming. Thank you for joining me today, Grace.
Hello.
Hi. I know you're busy, so let's just get right to the point, okay? Now, I wanted to talk about this urban rooftop project that's going on with this co-housing group. Can you explain what co-housing is?
Sure. Co-housing is an intentional neighborhood where people know each other and have the desire to share different aspects of their lives together. Everybody has their own private home. Privacy is very much valued in the community. But outside of the private home, there are shared amenities like a common dining room and kitchen, places for the kids to play, generally some outdoor space, guest rooms, and then larger communities will have larger facilities. But the idea is that you can have all the privacy you need inside your home, and as soon as you step out, your community is at your doorstep waiting for you to engage.
Now, I've heard of intentional communities before, but what I was surprised to hear about is it happening in urban environments?
So our community is very much in an urban environment. We're in Capitol Hill, which is a very urban neighborhood just to the east of the Central Business District in Seattle. We're one of I think we are the most dense neighborhood in Seattle. And it's quite a vibrant street life. There's lots of restaurants and bars and shops nearby, lots of coffee shops. Where our walk score, I think, is 97 or 98. So it's a very urban setting. We are on a very small lot. Our lot is about 4,500 square feet, so one-tenth of an acre. And that's quite different than most co-housing in the U.S. The other projects tend to be more suburban, and even if they are considered urban, they're sort of in smaller cities or in the outskirts of some of the larger metropolitan areas, and so they're not quite as dense. They're more in like single-family neighborhoods of cities. So we are quite dense and quite urban, and I think that's one of the exciting things that have drawn people to our community. We are only, because of our urban site and our small site, we are only 9 families.
Okay. So I think that's a little easier to control in terms of consensus when you have a smaller number of people.
Yes and no. everyone still has their own opinions. But, yeah, I think it's easier to reach consensus when there is a smaller group of people, you know, most certainly.
And what are there is there a theme with this group, something that drew you all together that you wanted to some rules or some ethics or something that brought you all together?
I would say that our site is actually the biggest thing that brought us together. We do have a set of a mission, a vision, and a set of values that do kind of bind us together. But those were created afterwards as a group, after we first started the group. I would say that a big central theme to that vision is sustainability. And that's not just from an environmental standpoint, but also kind of how we work as sort of a social network, and recognizing that we have a significant impact to our local economy, and that the way that we've chosen to live also impacts, you know, us financially in a sustainable way. So I would say that that's kind of the big underlying piece is sustainability. And I would say that's true for a lot of co-housing communities. Many of them would say that they hold sustainability high in terms of their values.
Okay, so you've got a fundraising project going on right now on barnraiser.us, and you're wanting to build an urban rooftop farm. And I want to know more about that. And the first thing that I'm curious about is you're calling it a farm and not a garden.
Mm-hmm.
What's
yeah.
the difference?
The big distinction in our mind was gardening is sort of a pastime or a hobby kind of thing, or could be seen as that, or it also could imply sort of something ornamental. And we wanted to make a statement that, you know, while we are a very small rooftop farm, our intention is to produce food year-round, and that is a commercial venture for somebody. And that somebody right now is the Seattle Urban Farm Company, who is a local company that helps businesses and individuals and developers build and maintain urban farms throughout the city of Seattle. And they are a, you know, for-profit company. They've started doing work with developers, doing rooftop gardens on multifamily projects. And this one is a little bit different in that we are going to be contracting that with them to maintain the farm. And then we have a local restaurant, a pretty shishy local restaurant that is interested in buying our produce, at least for the first couple of years. So that's kind of the distinction. We wanted to distinguish that we are a production farm. We're not having lots of different types of vegetables. I mean, we may over the course of time, but wanted to make a statement that it was a productive farm with a business model around it.
And how much area is there on this rooftop for farming?
So our site is 4,500 square feet, as I said before, and we are using about a third of the rooftop or the site area. So, you know, something over 1,500 square feet is the total area, including the walking surface. And then the beds are probably half of that. So it's not a lot of dirt that we're talking about, but it's but it is a significant amount, and we will be closely monitoring and analyzing the amount of food that we're producing in that first year to really have an understanding of what that will look like long term as we continue to manage the farm.
Right. So that's great. Now, people that want to support your particular project can find it at barnraiser.us, and it's the Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing Rooftop Farm.
Mm-hmm. And if you can't remember that, you can just Google Barnraiser Rooftop Farm, and you'll be able to find it.
So for people that are in the Seattle area, if they contribute, There are some nice gifts of produce and dinners with a local chef. And for those that are curious in rooftop gardening, I think it's just interesting to check this out and see what they're doing. I'm just curious about it. I live in New York City. We have a lot of apartments. We have a lot of rooftops. And wondering how to take advantage of that to farm. Do you have to do anything special to the roof in order to be safe in growing food?
So it's helpful to start off with a new construction project knowing that you're going to be building the farm because the weight of wet dirt is actually quite significant, and it's not something that most buildings are designed to accommodate, especially older buildings. So looking at an older rooftop in New York, unless it's a high rise that has, you know, concrete construction or something, or steel construction, it's probably not likely that you can support the load of a rooftop farm. But it's certainly possible to go back and retrofit. And so in our situation, we designed the rooftop not only for the farm on the one side, but for future photovoltaic panels so that we can generate our own energy. So the weight of those things are roughly comparable, and so both of our rooftop areas will be able to support that load. But that was designed in advance, and it comes at a cost as well as just the engineering fees. But our hope is that we will be a catalyst, not only for Seattle, but for other other cities, that they might recognize that you can start small and have a small rooftop and just build from there, because our interest is in having a food network in our neighborhood so that, you know, not just this one restaurant, but hopefully lots of restaurants and lots of people would be able to get fresh, organic, sustainably grown produce right in their neighborhood and not have to pay for the cost of transporting their food across the country or across the state, or paying for the carbon emissions from fertilizers and other things like that that are typical with our food production.
I love it, and I really hope that you get this project funded. It's already at $8,300, and you want $10,000 by August 21st.
But so yeah, $10,000 like is well our initial goal. We have two stretch goals that we are anticipating, because the real cost of it is quite more. We're trying to be realistic within the crowdsourcing strategy is. To set a realistic goal that you know that you can achieve and then do stretches, because if we don't meet our goal, then we don't get the money. So that's kind of been our strategy. So even though we're close to our goal, we're hoping to sort of max that goal out and push ourselves up a couple of stretch goals of 5,000 each.
Right. Well, this is really inspirational. And like you said, I hope this is really a model for others. We really need to take control of our food system, and everyone, to some degree, needs to be growing food somewhere, anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
really out of hand, and I just love this concept. And not only will you be making food, but it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And it's also teaching our kids where food comes from, that it doesn't come from cellophane bags and styrofoam containers.
Exactly. Children need to know where their food comes from, and they're more likely to want to eat healthy food when they're part of growing it. Okay, Grace. Well, thank you. Is there anything else you want to add about the rooftop farm and co-housing?
I would just add, if anyone's interested in learning more about the project, they can Google us, Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing. That will take you to our website where you can learn more about sort of who we are and our vision and values. And there's a link to the barn raiser from there. And the barn raiser has a great video, so please do check us out.
Okay, I'll also include a link on my website with this interview for anybody who wants to find out more. Great, thanks for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye. Take care. I am really fascinated by this, and I live in a co-op building in Queens. We're having a board meeting on Wednesday. I know the board would never go for something like this, but we're in a very strong concrete building, and we even have some space on the ground floor that, oh, my God, would be so great for a garden, but I don't think anybody would ever go for it. But, you know, maybe this is something to consider. And if you are with some like-minded people and you have an opportunity to move into a space together and you want to grow food, this is a great project and a great concept, and I hope more people do it. So there's that. All right. Some really incredible things are happening, and we had some breaking news yesterday. I don't know if you heard about it, but I have to share it because it has to do with food. We've talked about the Ag Gag many times on this program. I've had numerous people speaking to how dangerous it is. It's basically a law that has been put into place in, I think it's 7 states now, that is anti-whistleblowing. So whistleblowing is when somebody inside an organization, either undercover or not, reports things that are illegal or problematic within a company. And as you know, in factory farming, in confined animal feedlot operations, in the growing of animals to feed people, many of these facilities, they're completely closed in factories and they don't let anyone in, and it's impossible to know what's going on. So there are some brave, brave people that do undercover investigation, and because of these ag gag laws that are in place in a number of states, they specifically say that these investigations are illegal and there are significant penalties for those that are convicted of documenting animal cruelty or documenting life-threatening safety violations. You know, it's not just about documenting cruelty to non-human animals. It's also about documenting violations against fellow humans. And you'll find that those that can easily cause violence to animals, non-human animals, will easily do it to humans as well. Well, the good news, such good news, is that yesterday in Idaho, the ag gag law was ruled unconstitutional. And this is amazing, wonderful news. There were a number of groups that teamed up, including the Animal Legal Defense Fund and People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Center for Food Safety. And if you go to the Animal Legal Defense Fund website, ALDF.org, you can read the details about this amazing decision and read the court declaration. I think it's really good reading. I don't know how, if you've ever read a declaration or a court's ruling, but these documents are really fascinating, and you can, rather than read an article that gives you the sound bites, you can actually get the whole piece of information about what happened. And this one is so important that reading the entire ruling is, I think, really useful. One of the things that I absolutely loved about it was that the judge paid particular attention to, as Will Potter put in his blog post, the impact of the ag gag on journalism and news gathering. And he talked about the story of Upton Sinclair, the author of The Jungle. I don't know if you've read that. It's a great book. It talks about the meat packing plant in Chicago in the early 20th century. It's a fictional story. It's a really depressing story. And Upton Sinclair focused actually on the plight of immigrant labor, the plights of very poor humans. And although he talked about what was going on with the non-human animals, he wasn't really focusing on the treatment of non-human animals. It was about how the working conditions for people working in the stockyards. And as a result of that fiction book and the research that he did, we have the passage of the Federal Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act. But the judge noted that Upton Sinclair's conduct back in the early 20th century today would expose him as a criminal prosecution under this ag-gag ruling. This is so exciting that it's been struck down as unconstitutional, and this is something to celebrate. Woo! Now on to Utah and some of the other states that have this ag-gag. I plan on bringing on one of the council members from the ADLF and talk about this more in detail. I'm sorry, the ALDF, the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Don't want to mix up those letters in the acronym. We're going to be talking about it more in detail next week because I think this has great ramifications. So stay tuned for that, okay? All right, we just have a few more minutes left. Something I wanted to talk about that bugs me. Have you heard about some of these food products that are coming out? I don't know how to describe them. They're kind of like drinks or shakes, which free people from not only hunger, but also from having to eat food. So I read a variety of different articles how these high-tech engineers in Silicon Valley, for example, they want to work at their computers all day and all night. They don't want to focus on eating. And some creative folks have come up. There's a number of these different companies that are making these liquid meals, Schmoylent, Schmilk, People Chow, and the one I'm going to talk about today is Soylent. Have you heard about this? It's crazy, and I find it so depressing that there are these investors that would actually support a project like this. But Soylent is now on their 2.0 version. They've had a 1.0 and a 1.5, and now they're on a 2.0. Of course, they're making it sound like software upgrades, because that's what they're all about. And it's like they dialed in to hit all of the recommended daily allowances for a variety of nutrients so that you get a quarter of what you need in a serving of this drink. And it's supposed to have been crafted with the help of some medical doctor who has some background in nutrition. Well, you read the ingredients in this thing, and it's a disaster, a disaster. And why is it a disaster? Because more and more evidence shows that if you want to eat healthfully and live a long, happy, quality life, you want to eat whole foods, not processed foods. And this Soylent liquid meal is all processed. The first ingredients on this list, the first ingredients are canola and sunflower oil powder, sunflower oil. And then it goes on and on. It's a disaster. And, of course, they say on their website that this product is not organic and it is not GMO-free. They use GMO ingredients. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe there are some people that just don't like eating and they just want to eat to live. Well, fine. But I think, not that I look for food to be my only enjoyment in life. There are plenty of things that I love to do, run, jump, and play, breathe lovely air, feel the sun, etc., be with family and friends, hear music. There's so many wonderful things to do, but we need to eat. Why not make it enjoyable? That's all part of life, and this whole concept bugs me. Now, the last thing that bugs me, if it doesn't bug you, do you remember the movie Soylent Green? They actually named this product after Soylent, and if you remember that movie, Soylent was people. It was during a time of overpopulation, and it was a sci-fi film where they took people that were dying and dead and ground them up and fed them back to people in this nutritional drink called Soylent. Ooh, major ooh. All right, that's Soylent. Now you know about it. Please don't support it. And, you know, if you like the idea, let me know about it. But the thing is, there's all these nutrients listed here that they have, but the thing we know about whole foods is that there are nutrients we have not discovered yet. There are nutrients we don't know the name of that we get when we eat the whole food. And when we isolate vitamins this way, we're not getting what we need. And there's research that shows when we isolate vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin E and folic acid, for example, they don't work the same as when they come with all kinds of other nutrients. It's not healthy. In fact, it can be a negative result. It can promote disease when we eat these isolated forms of nutrition rather than the whole food. A disaster. All right. I just have a minute left, and gosh, I wanted to talk about all the wonderful foods that I've been preparing this week. Please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. I have some wonderful, delicious new recipes, a carrot bisque, which I've actually been enjoying eating cold since it's so hot. It's delicious, creamy, cool, great hot or cold, so, so easy to make. And then I made this wonderful frozen treat. I call it Popeye Sweet Sensation. It's one of these frozen soft serve that I made with frozen spinach and blueberries and cocoa, and it's delicious. Okay, thank you for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. Send me some emails, will you, at info@realmeals.org. And please, don't drink Soylent. No, 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 no. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.